You're listening to Ascending, the Olim Entrepreneurship Playbook, hosted by Alex Chandrovsky, an Aleph from San Francisco. Aliyah demands leaving the familiar, taking a risk and venturing towards the unknown. This podcast is a map that deconstructs the mindset and habits of Israel's most successful Olim. I'm here with Brian Polonsky, the CEO and founder of Top Valley Recruitment, a leading recruitment firm for the health industry. Brian has made Aliyah in August 2017 from Los Angeles. He's been in recruitment for over 10 years now. Overall, he has recruited over 100 people with a total compensation for his clients of over $10 million. The company specifically focuses on C-suite health professionals, and it's a pleasure to be able to meet and speak with you.
It's a pleasure to have me on board. Thank you.
So this is I wish you could see Brian's office, because I'm surrounded right now by aromatherapy, these beautiful plants. I'm in the heart of Nachlaot, where actually my wife and I lived for our first year. We were right a few blocks away from you. So this is a gorgeous setting to talk about. How do you create such a great environment in your home for an office?
Well, like any smart man should say, my wife. My wife is the decorator of the home. And I will say that we also co-share the office, as this is a place that she sees clients, so she needs to create a certain atmosphere and energy as well in here. So that's why it does have this very positive and just unique energy in the office, which has helped me with work as well, I'll be honest. Not my traditional office, but I enjoy it.
This is not a cubicle, that's what
no, not at all.
I'm trying to say. So can you tell me a little bit about how does the business of recruiting work?
Business of recruiting is actually a lot simpler than people think. It is a multi-billion dollar industry, the headhunting industry, and it's the business of relationships like any other business. You juggle two relationships. You have your accounts, which are the places that are looking to hire people, the employers. For me, that would be a hospital. We'll use that as the example. And then there's the candidates, the people who are seeking jobs, or typically I go for people not looking for jobs, because the best people in the industry are passive clients. And you essentially are like a shadchan. You are a matchmaker. You're the middle person between these two. And by having good relationships with the account side, with the hospitals, they're going to give you job orders, or you're going to do unique things to open up job orders or to be able to get positions that you can recruit for them. And then you go to your candidates, which a lot of times people have a pool of candidates they can already choose from, or you can go seek out new candidates. But really, it's just the business of relationship and bringing two parties together and making a match.
Amazing. Wow. So you are, you know, they say that if you have three matches, that you make you go to heaven. So you have over 100. So you're basically could stop now. There's nowhere, no need to move forward. Tell me a little bit about why did you focus on healthcare? That's a really interesting niche to carve out.
So it wasn't 100% by choice, because I actually landed as a 23-year-old right out of college, 2 months out, being mentored by a woman who was restarting her business just a mile, which in LA is a blessing, from my house. And this was her focus. It was basically leaders in the hospital setting. And although most people think, you know, why limit yourself? Why niche down so much? There's 250 hospitals in LA alone. There are dozens of people who what I do just in LA alone. And so there's still plenty of business to go around. And we focused on that business. And really, because we were local and because we had the connections, we had our finger on the pulse of the industry and people respected what we did. And it enabled us to become really, I think, one of the a boutique firm who people saw that were small but cared about them. And so when I made Aliyah, I just restarted it as my own business. I said, why go try to do something else? I have the relationships. I understand this market. And let's go in and start from there. Who knows where to go from there? But I thought, why not, you know, put my chips in where I've kind of already put a lot of them in before.
Amazing. So can you explain what some of the pain points, both from the individual who you're the company that's hiring you, and the individual you're potentially trying to recruit? How do you identify the pain points? What are those pain points that you're trying to address? And also, one thing that I just want to make you can focus on, like, your ideal clients are people who are not looking for jobs. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that as well?
Sure,
that's
absolutely.
Such a cool line. I like
Thank
that.
You. I appreciate that. It's a great question, because my whole philosophy in sales is understanding pain points. And I say typically everyone has different pain points. You need to be able to identify what that pain point is for them. On the account side, meaning on the hospital, the employer side, they're typically the same. A lot of times, I'll share this, HR, they're not us. They're not salespeople per se. This isn't their full-time job. And so a lot of times they're doing more administrative work. They don't have a background in sales. They're getting paid hourly. They're not getting paid commission like myself. And so this essentially isn't always their strongest asset, you could say. And so hospitals, not only, what's the most important thing to any single company? Profits. Where do profits come from? Hiring the right people. Hiring the right people. I just read an article online the other day by what are the three most important things to a CEO. And it said 37% of like a CEO's concern is around talent. Oh. So this is where, and you know this, an organization is successful if it has good leaders. It's typically not successful if it doesn't have good leaders. Doesn't matter if you have, you know, a magic lamp. It depends on its leaders.
A and magic lamp would be helpful.
A magic lamp would be helpful.
As long as it actually does matter.
But if you had a magic lamp and you had someone who didn't know how to use the magic lamp, it essentially would be worthless.
It's just worthless.
Exactly.
That's a plug for Aladdin, the movie, which is out now. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
We are not involved in the movie whatsoever. No.
Yeah. So they are not professionals in that space. So you reach out, essentially. You are contracted out.
Yes. And I'll be honest, a lot of times they don't want to use us because we cost a lot of money. And we don't always make people in the HR side look good because we're kind of doing their job for them. Yeah. But a lot of companies have budgets for recruiting firms. And what I try to find on a pain point side is a lot of times you can find literally a dollar amount, meaning how much does it cost to hire a new person? If this position's open for longer than X amount of months, how much is it costing you? I just spoke to a CEO the other day. And I found out that by having this C-level person in this position, he saves $2 million on just one area a year. And so I said, so if I hear this correctly, is that $180,000 a month? He said, yes. I said, so this person who just left last week, if you don't hire someone in a two-month period even, which is very standard to hire a C-level person in less than 2 months, I said, you're out $360,000 and then it just keeps adding on to that. He said, yes. I said, so then paying for my service, even if it was $100,000, would be worth it, wouldn't you say? And he says, yes. So a lot of times you can equate a dollar amount even to their pain point, but there's lots of other pain points. Staff leaves as well if their leadership isn't there. Business development comes to a halt. There's a lot of other things. Wow. Now on the candidate side, where I think there's major psychology, is people typically change a job for one reason and one reason only. There are peripheral ones, but there's typically one reason and one reason only. And it takes a very savvy recruiter, and it takes, when I mean savvy, I mean someone who is a good listener, great at asking questions, and number one, has empathy and really doesn't go after what the shiny object is. For example, someone says, you know, I want a job with more money. Because then typically if you just listen and go quiet, and they go, I really want a job with more money, and then I go quiet. In my head, two, three. And they go, well, I really also want a place where I can grow. And then I go, oh, that's the pain point. And so people will reveal this. And a lot of times they're just not changing jobs because changing jobs it's a scary thing to leave what's comfortable and it's stressful. And just like buying a house, you want to make sure you have a good real estate agent and it's a big decision to make. And so you need someone to help hold your hand through the process and keep you focused on what's most important to you, because your emotions will kick in and you'll retreat back to what's safe or get focused on other things. And I'll help people focus on what's important. Small example, just had a client leave a job who she's out in the Palm Desert area of Los Angeles. It's far out from Los Angeles. It's kind of in the middle of nowhere. She's a city girl. Now we got her some more money. The position wasn't any bigger. And she initially shared with me she wants this bigger position, everything. But I knew that her pain point was she wants to be near the city. She wanted excitement. So I knew if we could at least get her a job where making more money is always good. It's in a similar position, but in a new environment. So she's getting different experience and she's near the city. It's a win for everyone. And I had her stay focused on the city and she made the move. She's ecstatic about it. And so that's really our job, is to find the pain point. And that comes from asking good questions and from listening and letting people's vulnerabilities show up and then be able to help them really stay focused on that and hold their hand through the process.
I mean, this is really gold. I mean, clearly you're a person, the empathy piece is so crucial, the way you shared and caring about the client, and for both clients, seeing it's a good fit. You mentioned something about being, is it commission based typically, or is it hourly based? How is the relationship usually, are you only paid if you identify and get a client, or is it different levels? If the interview happens, you get a little bit of the batch, and then if they go through, how does the compensation usually work in the industry?
Great question. So if you are a lot of time recruiting interim or contract temporary people, a lot of times you'll be paid monthly. So essentially, you'll get a percentage of what they make every month. So they might stay 2 years. That's a good business. However, you'll take on more liability because a lot of times now they become like an employee through you. So it makes things a little more difficult.
Clearly, the empathy is a huge piece, like you mentioned, in this industry, understanding and really guiding the person through through the process of making sure this is the right decision for them, understanding their pain points. Incredible. And again, and the best people, how do you identify those people who are ready to leave or would consider leaving and at the same time are not proactively looking to leave? How do you identify those people?
I think that might be one of the most fun parts of recruiting. And what sets aside, I think, working in maybe more higher level recruiting, leadership, executive level versus a lot of times staff level. It's not hard when people come to you. And typically in the recruiting industry, the best people, not just in the recruiting industry, Brian Tracy says, you want to know what your worth is? How many people would hire you right now? That's one of my favorite Brian Tracy's famous sales trainer. How many people would hire you right now? And for really valuable people, we know the answer is typically a lot. And so people like this don't have to go look for a job. Essentially, someone has to lure them away. And so as a recruiter, I'm typically going after the creme de la creme in the business. These are people who are passive candidates not looking, but I will typically find a pain point of theirs. And they're typically people a little comfortable, a little bit beyond their comfortability. 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. You know what? Yeah, you know what? That I do really want to pursue that. Or that is important to me. Or you know what? Yeah, let's do it. Or I'll have a conversation. And those people are typically the best. Also because they're not going to make a hasty decision. It's not typically fueled by emotion or by pressure. If you have to put food on your family's table or other reasons of just constriction, then you might make a decision that is just based on desperation. But when you are happy in your job, and I'll tell people, they go, I'm happy. I go, great, you're the exact kind of person I work with. I actually prefer to work with people who are happy because I know at the end of the day, they're going to compare apples to apples and either make sense or it doesn't. And it's very easy when you're already pretty content with your job.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's really resonating with me, what you just said, is that these individuals, right, they are in a place of, they're happy where they're at. At the same time, they're looking potentially for something more if you identify their pain point. And it takes me to this notion that I'm encountering a lot because I have people reaching out to me asking for, should I become an entrepreneur, right? Should I essentially, either start a business or they potentially lost a job or left a job and maybe now this is their chance. And my approach is entrepreneurship, but I say to them, you should assume that you cannot do it. That's my assumption. Two is, if you're coming to become an entrepreneur from a specific pain point of, you have no money, you have no security, and you have a family to feed, I really want you to be making this decision from a really healthy, strong place of security, right? Because you'll be able to make a stronger set of decisions when you're in the place of security, right?
Sure.
And what I love about what you're saying is about the clients that you're attracting is, again, you're looking for people who have security, right? But you're teaching them on a very deep, like a much more deeper need, right? It's a much deeper need of like, what do you really, this has to be genuine. It can't be a decision made out of necessity because you're asking people to make a commitment long-term to switch, right? It's a big commitment. Mm-hmm. They're very valuable.
Yeah.
You want to make sure they come from a place of abundance and security. So this all leads me to a question that I have with you. You've been running your own business in recruitment specifically. I know you have a phone training business as well for the last 2 years, but you were an apprentice to someone for a long time, right? Can you talk a little bit about the sense of how can entrepreneurs start or get trained in the future business while working for somebody?
Okay. This question comes up all the time. I am not a huge Gary Vaynerchuk fan. He's a little too crass for me, but someone asked a similar question at a lecture or something he was giving, and he said, you don't just quit your $100,000, $150,000 maybe job that you have as a developer to start your business. You start working on it on the side until it becomes profitable and until maybe it can cover your expenses. Then maybe you pull the trigger. And so it's hard to argue, besides obviously things like drive and humility and coachability, that having a mentor and apprenticeship in whatever you're in, especially business, is not the most important thing in business. It's hard for me not to argue that that is.
Yeah.
Not just because that was my experience, but because I've seen this over and over again. We especially live in a world today where you cannot be good at a lot of things. You have to be a master at your craft. And so by learning underneath someone who has already done it, not only do you have a better chance of becoming a master at your craft, but you're avoiding all the other pitfalls and you're kind of on the expressway as well. Now, when I mean expressway, it's not wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, like many people think it is today, or unfortunately a lot of millennials. I made $24,000 my first year out of college, no benefits, but I then made, I think, 48 my next year, and it started to double and double. It's because I put in hard work every day and I made 100 phone calls no matter what, and I had a mentor. And so I think, number one, you have to seek out a mentor, and even if that means scraping by and barely paying your rent, it is such an investment in the long term. You will never, ever, ever, ever regret it.
So can you talk a little bit about your mentor that you worked under for 5 years? Because there's clearly a very special relationship there. Can you share with me what you learned from her, if you don't mind sharing her name? Or
sure, absolutely. She's more than just a mentor. She's a lot of things to me. Her name's Rebecca Kahn. She ran Spectrum Recruiting, still does. Rebecca worked in the garment industry, actually, in downtown LA for many years. And Rebecca's whole philosophy, and it's not one that hasn't been heard in sales before, but it's not one that people can internalize. And that is, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And I'm going to say it again, because people always ask me to repeat it twice. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And this was Rebecca's philosophy, and said, you have to drop your ego out the door and you have to empathize and really focus on people and listen to them and find that pain point and those pain points so you can serve them. And Rebecca was sitting next to me for 2 years, I think, before we actually hired on another employee. And I would get off the phone and she'd say, so what about this? I'd say, I don't know. She'd go, call them back. I sometimes would call someone back 9 times in a row and ask them different questions. And I actually thought this was an embarrassing thing, but I actually found that I actually built trust in my clients, because not only did they see that I was humble, they saw I was working for them, and it helped me learn to dot all my I's and cross all my T's.
And so can you act that out? Can you explain what you mean by that? You called them 9 times in a row. What does that mean?
Perfect.
Can you give me a scenario?
Great question. So let's say I was recruiting an emergency room director for a job.
Very important.
important position.
Yeah, I would say you want the right guy for that job.
So you want the right guy. And I call up a guy and I get off the phone with him, and Rebecca says, I turn to her all excited, I got this great candidate. And she goes, awesome. She goes, so how many people does he manage? And I go, I don't know, but I know he really wants a job. She goes, call him back. And I call him back and go, hey, John, how many people do you manage? 113. Great. Put down the phone. And I say, Rebecca, he's got 113. She goes, awesome. Who does he report to? And I go, I think he reports to the director. Are you sure? I don't know. Call him back. And I had someone who was just on me all the time. And I was able to leave my ego at the door, and I was able to be trained. I can't say I always leave my ego at the door. I'm trying, and it's a constant battle, not just for myself, I think for everybody. And especially when you get very good at something, it gets hard again, because you have to go back, because now you think you know how to do it. So I'm still working on it today, And I have still mentors in my life and still friends that I go to and do this, but that's...
If you're in an industry which is highly commission-based,
yeah,
how do you retain empathy and the interest of the client, the heart, when it's competing with, you know, I've seen some sales trainings, I'm not going to mention some names, but I'm constantly being targeted online on Facebook. Yeah. And it's like, let me show you five ways how I can tackle objections. Or if they're not certain, this is two ways that I'm going to, sure, you know, and part of it is, seems like, you know, we're trying to get them to a certain conclusion, which not necessarily is the right conclusion for them.
Mm-hmm.
So can you share just a moment about how do you have the best interest of the client in mind,
sure,
while working in the very much a commission-based business?
Great sales question. First off, if you're not a person with integrity, this question is almost irrelevant to you. And what I mean by that is maybe you need to align your understanding of business with your integrity, meaning that the slow dollar is always better than the quick dime, especially if you're in the business of relationships. And if you don't know the Pareto principle, you should, and that's typically that 80% of your business comes from 20% of your clients. You might have 20 people you work with, but a lot of times there's four accounts that are bringing you in a significant amount of your money. I can say that's true for my business and always has been that way, actually. And so, number one, you shouldn't take on business that essentially you can't do or you're not going to be able to deliver. And you have to be able to say to someone, this is not in your best interest. And I have told accounts, this candidate wants the job with you and you want them, and I don't think you should hire them because it's not going to be a good fit, or I know they're actually going to leave after a year. And although they would pass the guarantee point where I'm still going to get paid and don't have to pay back anything, I don't want you guys to look for this after a year because I know the direction things are heading. But it's your choice and I'll respect whatever you do.
Hmm. Amazing. Community and relationships. It's clearly something you go back to. You're in the business of relationships. You are very involved in AAPI. That's clearly a big part of your life.
Oh, yeah.
A fraternity is... You know, as a brotherhood, it is about relationships. Can you tell me a little about what you learned through AAPI? Why was that such a big part of your life? You know, just in the few minutes that we have left together.
No better way to end it off than on AAPI. AAPI might be, besides my family, my parents, my family, the single most influential facet of my entire life. College was not an ideal ground for developing my skill sets in terms of academia. I'm a salesperson, I'm a business person, I'm a leader. And I didn't find any majors that were, I think I switched majors 7 times, that would support that. AAPI is the single greatest investment you can make for not only building your interpersonal skills, but also your leadership skills, business skills, and the network is unparalleled. And so, my first semester in AAPI, I was on the recruitment committee. Surprise, surprise, 10 years later, I became a, sorry, 4 years later, I became a professional recruiter, and it's what helped me bring in $10 million worth of clients and helped me be able to move to Israel. But it is a breeding ground because it models itself in a way that teaches you life skills. And running a business and a brotherhood at the same time is the greatest thing. And
can you talk to that a little bit? Because it's so fascinating.
It's hard to understand unless you are in a fraternity.
What does it mean you're running a business and a brotherhood at the same time?
The challenge with a fraternity is that it is a business and it is a brotherhood, so you have to juggle the two. But I think the beauty of that is when you really do business with someone, when you do a fundraiser with them, when you do social events with them, when you do, we do a lot of things for the Jewish world, pro-Israel, when you do those things, it's a much different relationship than when you just hang out with friends and go to parties and concerts and sit around and not do much. So you're essentially building together. And when you're building together, you're building on that relationship. And AAPI is built where it has 9 executive positions, and their positions along the lines of someone who manages the property, someone who's the accountant, someone who is the secretary, someone who's in charge of program development. There's a president, and there's a budget of $250,000 or more a year, and there is recruitment, there is PR, there is marketing, there is motivation, there are operational development.
So it's like a playground where you're learning all these life skills, which you wouldn't get necessarily in a classroom. Incredible. I mean, that's API. I hope you guys are listening, because I think you got the best recruitment policy right here. We're gonna end off with these two questions here.
Sure.
But this is a big one. Aliyah.
Mm-hmm.
Aliyah. You're building this business, Los Angeles. You're getting to a place where you're making a very significant amount of personal revenue, sure, and also you're helping people tremendously. You have a great mentor. Why Aliyah in 2017? Why are you leaving Los Angeles? You're a Kodesh to Israel. What's the motivation?
So not to get into my whole Kozer but Teshuvah story of how I came to being a God believer, because I didn't for 28 years of my life and following Torah. I had a very good life on paper, almost like my candidate, someone who has the perfect resume but fails the interview. I had the perfect life. I lived near my rabbi, my volunteer work, I went on vacation, I had a job a mile from home in LA, which is
unheard of,
and godsend. I was at the top of my business, I had a beautiful home, I was buying two more homes, I had a great car, I had great friends. Why leave it? I wanted to live in a community where there was a different focus. The values were different. It was not focused on, I think, as material things. And there was a rich community, and that's very hard to find in America. I grew up in the Bay Area, in a small town with no movie theater, no mall, 27 parks, like a kibbutz. You walk to your neighbor's house. It now costs $2 million to buy a house like my parents had. Thank God, but also not thank God, because I, you know, I can't afford to live there. And it's not the same anymore. And Israel is like that. And maybe this will be your final question. And I believe that I was, not I believe, but I know that when you're a salesperson, and I want to say even a business person, you can make it anywhere in the world. And I was never going to let dictate, you know, there's better taxes in Texas, so I'm going to move to Texas. I see a lot of people doing that. You're going to give up your quality of life, possibly, to save some money somewhere? If you're a real salesperson and a business person, you will always find a way to create opportunities. And I knew that once I had these skill sets, not even understanding this industry, but then you add in understanding a business and having a model for success, there was no fear in making Aliyah, because I knew I would end up doing well.
Yeah,
and thank God, in the first short time I've started my business, God has blessed me tremendously, and I hope He continues to bless me. And although some things cost a lot more in Israel than they do in America, you're not going to own three cars. Health insurance is not insanely through the roof. You're not going to the mall and Target constantly spending money. And I've done the calculations, and you can live here, I believe, with an incredible quality of life without maybe some of all, you know, all the bells and whistles, but the quality of life and not being pressured to make, you know, $250,000 or more a year to live relatively comfortable.
Yeah. When speaking with other Olim, there is a huge reality of individuals leaving.
Yeah.
Right? I'm sure you have had friends leave.
Mm-hmm.
I have had friends leave. The people who come for certain reasons are not going to be the same reason why they stay 2 years later. Can you tell me how your reason has evolved? How have you been consistently, what kind of attitude have you formed in order to be able to be successful as an Ola in this country? Because again, it's not your language, you don't have the connections that maybe, you didn't go to the army, you didn't go to 8200, like, you know, we are immigrants, right? And the comforts, while the quality of life initially might be different, 2 years later, life kicks in, right? Marriage, children, family, apartments.
Sure.
So how has your ability to stay and grow in Israel with that commitment, how have you kept that positivity in place, you know, while so many people have left?
Well, first, there was a study done a couple of years ago where they surveyed Americans and found out what Americans thought, why people, what was the biggest problem concerning Israel? And Americans, Pareto principle again, said 80% of Israelis are concerned about terrorism and 20% about the economy. And when they surveyed Israelis, what'd they find? The complete opposite. And I myself have found this time and time again. People love living here. Even Israelis who are frustrated with the bureaucracy and have grown up here, I have found for the most part, people love living here. It is just economically not, maybe they don't think it's in the cards for them. They don't feel it's viable. And so I really believe that if you have, I don't want to say the skill sets because I don't want that to sound also inherent. I believe they can be developed. And I really believe everyone has the potential to be an entrepreneur or something of the making, and especially with the way the world is today with the internet and different things, that if you're able to make money, if there's other things that are deal breakers for you, your family's home, or you have to raise your kids around your grandparents, or there's a major issue, whatever it may be, or the terrorism is something that does bother you, then I can understand why you'd move back to America or somewhere else in Chutz La'aretz. Of all, for most people, I find it's money. And so, thankfully for me, I have never truly worried so much, I feel like, about money, because even before I had some muscle of emunah, because I know that I have focused on building one of my most important muscles of having business skills, having sales skills. And I've always wholeheartedly believed that if you have that, everyone needs to hire a great salesperson. So no matter what, you're never without a job. So you're either going to create your own job or someone's going to hire you. And so that all the other stuff, there's challenging things here. We all know there's lots of hoops you have to jump through and barriers. I haven't even learned Hebrew yet. It's a challenge for me. But I believe all these things are learned. And if you can't afford to live somewhere, though, I can see how that would, force you to maybe change your life.
Rapid fire questions, and then you take us
My
out.
favorite.
In order for your business, what kind of VOP system do you use, or what kind of phone do you use? Can you just share a little bit about,
Sure.
obviously phone quality is really important, and probably just even that you want to make sure that your number shows up as an 818 number, Los Angeles area. Can you just talk a little bit, just very practically?
Sure. I'm using Anatel now. Anatel was referred to me by actually a guy that I coached who runs a business from American business from here. I like Anatel because they have English speaking American mentality customer service, and that's important to me. And my number shows up as a Los Angeles number, and it even has texting and sends a voicemail to my email. So it's worked great for me so far.
Wonderful. Do you use your own phone or do you do it over the computer?
My own phone.
Just straight up from your phone. Great.
$30 a month, pretty cheap business to run.
Awesome. Zoom or phone?
I'm using phone. I don't do anything yet with
Oh,
video
video.
interviews.
Interesting.
I might be a little, I'm not, I might be, I am a little bit old school, and that's something a lot of recruiters are implementing. But as of now, I've been using the same model for 10 years, and it's pretty good.
How do you deal with working West Coast hours in Israel? Just for people who understand, that's a
Sure.
10-hour difference. It's a 1-0, 10.
So it's not easy, but I believe everything in life is a trade-off. And my goal, I actually brought this up to my wife like 2 weeks ago, I was laughing, was I remember I said, I want on my tombstone someday to say, he invented the 4-day work week. That was something I said like 12 years ago. And I actually only work 4 days a week now. I work Monday through Thursday. So I have an extra day off Sunday every week. It's an adventure day. My wife and I went to the beach yesterday and had a great time yesterday. And I also have my mornings free to learn. We have a 2-hour lunch as well during the day, and we go for a walk. And right now I'm working a little late, I think, because I'm still in the hustling and creating mode. But also, if you're making good money and potentially American money, you might be able to work till 1:30 at night at the latest, and still get up at 7. Depends how much sleep you need. I don't need a lot of sleep, and so it's a trade-off as of right now. And I'm working a little later than usual, but I'm also a night owl too, so it's not challenging for
Do
me.
you use what kind of CRM do you use?
So I'm using Salesforce for now, $25 a month, and it's good for expanding. And one of my goals we didn't talk about was I really want to help keep Olim in Israel, and I want to be able to hire people and train them to do this business in Israel.
What are some of the other tools that you are using practically to software or
Sure.
hardware that we should know about?
So I would have
How do you
loved.
sleep 5.5 hours?
So I would have loved to have talked about this in the interview, but one of my biggest business pieces of advice are you need very little to get started. I still don't have a website. I didn't even start with a company name. I didn't even have a phone with an LA number when I started. And not to say these things aren't important or good for expansion, but all I use, and I'll be honest, I haven't even used my Salesforce as much as I wanted to, is a Gmail account, a phone, a contract, and some kind of database, whatever helps you be organized. Stom, that is it, all you need to start a company. Don't get lost in all the other details. Bring out the Israeli in you and just yalla, just begin. That is the most important thing. Don't be paralyzed by trying to figure out all the details. Begin your business. You'll fill them in later. I actually did and am still doing it.
Amazing. Any last words before we go that you want to share with potential Aleem, and how can they get in touch with you?
They can get in touch with me via my email. I don't know which one I gave you, but it's the best one actually is BrianJPolonsky@gmail.com. My first name, my middle initial, and my last name at gmail.com. And last pieces of advice is trust in God and put in the hard work, and don't overcomplicate things for you, and focus on one thing and just don't stop.
Amazing. Well, I'll tell you what, one thing that really stood out for me was your emphasis on empathy as a salesman and a person who does business development, is approaching place from a deep sense of service and empathy, and then that will always result. Like you said, the slow dollar is much quicker than the quick dime.
Not quicker, but it's
more valuable.
It's more valuable.
All right. Thank you, Brian. Thank you so much. And we're really, really grateful for your wisdom. It's great to have you part of our community.
Thank you, and it's really great to have you doing this for the community. It is a constant conversation amongst all Olim, even the ones doing well, and I think this is absolutely essential, and it's bringing, it's we're talking about ER directors, they're in the triage. You're bringing them the gauze. You're stopping the bleeding. This is incredible.
Love it.